Are there even letters in them, or you just wear them with those, like, curved?
I call this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. There is a quorum present. Before we get to our agenda, I'll just go through a few items. Everyone here today must be seated when they're in the hearing room. There's no standing or sitting in the walkways or aisles, and if you need accommodation, please let our staff know. Signs are not permitted in the hearing room or at the testifiers' tables. Signs should be left outside. Clapping and other disruptions are not allowed. And then finally, all testifiers who have signed up in advance have been provided with a time limit for testimony in advance. Please adhere to these limits or you may be cut off. We just try to keep things moving because we always have a lot of bills and we want to make sure that our members have full discussion on the bills before we vote. With that, we will move to approval of the March 5th, 2024 meeting minutes. Representative Curran, may I have a motion to approve the minutes for March 5th, 2024?
So moved, Chair.
Representative Curran moves approval of the minutes for March 5th, 2024. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for March 5th, 2024 are approved. Our first bill on the day is House File 3555. This is Representative Rarick's bill. Welcome back to the committee, Representative Rarick. We will be laying this bill over, so I move to lay over House File 3555. And Representative Rarick, I believe you have an author's amendment, the A2. I'll just note for the committee that it's probably not worth having Representative Rarick explain that now and explain it with the bill later on when she gets into that. And so is that okay with you, Representative Rarick?
Yes, Madam Chair, that would be great. It's a very technical amendment, so I appreciate that.
All right, so I will move the A2 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. And before Representative Rarick explains the bill as amended, we do have Director Elwell and Superintendent Evans here to give us some sort of background information on how this bill came to be. And so if Suzanne Elwell can step forward and give us a little background on the Criminal Sexual Conduct Working Group. That would be great. Welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Mueller and members of the committee. My name is Suzanne Elwell. I'm the director of the Crime Victim Justice Unit in the Office of Justice Programs, Minnesota Department of Public Safety. In 2019, the Minnesota legislature directed the Department of Public Safety to convene a multidisciplinary working group to examine the statutory framework for criminal sexual conduct crimes. I was the coordinator of the Criminal Sexual Conduct Statutory Reform Working Group that met for over a year, and we presented a report to the legislature in 2021. Throughout the discussions in the working group, committees, and subcommittees, members raised questions about the predatory offender registry requirements for convicted CSC crimes. Questions centered on the registration of juveniles, restart provisions, and offenses and circumstances that trigger the registration requirement. A consistent theme in these conversations concerned the lack of data available regarding the predatory offender registry system. Ultimately, the report to the legislature included a recommendation for the creation of another working group devoted to this topic, which the legislature adopted through the creation of the Predatory Offender Statutory Framework Working Group in 2021.
All right, thank you so much. And before we get to the bill too, we'll have Superintendent Evans come up and give the committee a brief description about the predatory offender registration system. And then I'll also note for members that the predatory offender working group report was actually in the packet with House File 4020. So if you want to make sure you have that, it's posted online as well, as is the criminal sexual conduct working group report that Director Elwell just talked about. Welcome back to the committee, Superintendent. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Drew Evans. I'm the current superintendent of the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. One of the various duties that the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension has is maintaining Minnesota's predatory offender registration system. That registration system began back with the abduction of Jacob Wetterling, and we began registering sex offenders, is what the term was at the time, on August 1st of 1991. And so our registry has been around for a number of years. All states in the United States have some form of a registry at this point in time, and it's under an umbrella as well of a national registry, which is referred to often as SORNA, which is the Sex Offender Registration and Notification Act. But we maintain a state registry, and that is the primary vehicle in which individuals that are deemed necessary to register in the state of Minnesota. There have been a number of additions and changes to the registry over the years by the legislature, and most importantly, beginning with Katie Poyer's abduction in 2000 is when a number of additional registration requirements and individuals came online at that time. At that time, Minnesota changed to what we refer to our registry as the Predatory Offender Registry because it encompasses a larger subset of individuals than just those that are convicted of sexual offenses, as noted. And then we've also made additions in 2005 with the Adam Walsh Protection and Safety Act, and then a number of different smaller revisions over time. What for the group, and I'm happy to answer any questions. I know that we'll get to the substance of the bill at this moving in. As of 3/6 of 2024, we have 18,700 individuals that are registered in the state of Minnesota. Nearly 40,000 individuals have registered over the lifetime of this registry in the state. In this, and important to your work here, there are 287 individuals that are only convicted of false imprisonment. So they have no other sexual offense or underlying offenses, simply that offense alone from there. The average age of the individual on our registry is 44, but it ranges from juveniles all the way to elderly individuals from there. And we currently have 7,194 lifetime registrations, meaning individuals, because of the way the statutory framework works, that they are required to register for the life. Time. The other individuals generally are required to register for a period of 10 years, and then they, based on the determination as to additional offenses aren't committed throughout that time, then they are removed from the registry once they've completed that registration period. And so I think that would be a good place to pause. I'm happy to answer any questions about the registry, or I can turn it over to Rep. Rarick.
Thank you, Superintendent. I think what we'll do is hold off on any questions right now and have Representative Rarick explain the Predatory Offender Registration Working Group and also House File 3555. So Representative Rarick, whatever order you want to take that in is fine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just going to talk briefly about the work of the working group, the Predatory Offender Working Group. And they started meeting August 30th of 2021, and they ended their work in November. So it was a very quick few months, but very intense. And I would say that the top four things that they started with, and they broke down into three different subgroups from this, but one was eliminating or limiting registration requirements for adjudicated juveniles. And we spent quite a bit of time trying to discuss whether or not we thought collectively if juveniles should be on the registry or not. And it should be noted that they're statutorily, it could be as young as 10 years old on the registry. So that was a big, it was a big discussion back and forth. The next one was applying registration requirements to convictions only, not same set of circumstances. So it's, I'd almost invite you to read the statute, which is 243.166, which is the registry predatory offender requirements, and it's very encompassing. So it is one of the few places in statute that includes same set of circumstances, so not just the crime that you committed, but if you had a sex offense that was charged, and in that same set of circumstances, there are many, many other things, then you could still land on the predatory offender list, which we will get into in a little bit. But one of the conversations was applying registration requirements to convictions only, or not the same set of circumstances. The third would have been to eliminate or modify the restart provisions. That is something that is addressed in this bill, and I'll talk about that in a minute. The fourth was providing an avenue for relief from registration. We kind of called this the off-ramp. So you had heard that over 40,000 in total had been on the registry at one time, and we have 18,700 on the registry right now. And there is no avenue for relief from that. That was discussed at great length as well. So to the bill, one other quick thing too from the Predatory Offender Reform Working Group. So one of the items that came up in this discussion was one of the requirements or lists of things that you could, a crime that could be committed where you would land on the predatory offender list would be false imprisonment. We had quite a bit of conversation about false imprisonment. Now, kidnapping is also there, but this is quite different. And for those that are prosecutors in the room, and I see a shaking head, false imprisonment is, it could be a very, very brief detainment of somebody. It is usually committed in conjunction with other things that are not sexual, like a drug offense or domestic violence. While those things are bad, they are not the intent of the predatory offender list. So we focused quite a bit of time on false imprisonment, and it, the stories really did start to come out. So under false imprisonment, it seemed to be an interesting tool, I'll call it that, of prosecutors that they would say, well, you've got a domestic violence charge, and there was sort of a bargaining back and forth of, well, I won't charge you with false imprisonment as part of the set of circumstances if you plead to something else, because what that does is that puts you on the predatory offender registry. So that seemed, well, again, those things are bad. It wasn't the intent of the predatory offender list. The intent of the predatory offender list is to keep close track of those that are the most dangerous in our society. That's why it was created. That's what happened with Jacob Wetterling. So when Jacob Wetterling was abducted, we had no database whatsoever to look for possible suspects. So it was birthed out of that in 1991, as you heard from the superintendent. The intent of it is to, again, keep close eye on those folks and have a really good, efficient tool for law enforcement. In all of these changes that we are making in this bill, it is the intent that this tool would be fine-tuned and be the best tool available for law enforcement. So I'm going to go now into some of the specific things of the bill itself. So the bill itself, after we have removed the, in the amendment, we removed the requirements for data, simply because we just don't have quite enough money, as the chair probably pointed out, in this biennium, or in this session, to pay for that. The data that is requested, if you look at the underlying bill, is very encompassing of, okay, so we have this registry, what are we using it for? Has it been successful? Are you actually closing cases? You know, are you getting convictions? Is it doing what it's supposed to do? And none of those answers could be answered because of the way that the predatory offender list has been set up and added to, as you heard from Superintendent Evans. With each major tragedy in Minnesota regarding this sort of thing, whether it was Drew Shadeen, whether it was Katie's Law, or others along the way, it has grown, and it, the database isn't very useful for extracting information like that out. So the request for data is, for right now, we're just going to say we're going to set it aside, we're going to revisit it. But if you read through those components, it really is, what is this doing? Is it solving crimes? Is it useful for law enforcement? That's essentially what the data was. So just because of financial constraints, we're not doing that now. What's left in the bill are basically four of the big components, which is removing false imprisonment from the crimes for which you would register. And I did talk about that at great length, so I'm not gonna go into that more. But it's, we want crimes committed that are sexual in nature or predatory in nature to be registrably a registrable offense. False imprisonment just has not done that. And you heard the superintendent say how many people were on it solely because of false imprisonment. The second thing that it does is it limits the extension of the person's time on the registry to only sexually based offenses. So only offenses that are currently on the registry, if you violate one of those, then you would extend your time. 10 years is the time, unless it's a lifetime. So if you spend one day in jail, then your 10 years starts all over again. Now, that one day in jail might be because of a DUI or domestic violence. Again, while those things are bad, they are not directly related to the predatory offender list. So it restarts it only under things that are specifically to what's already on the predatory offender list. The third thing it does is, which is the last paragraph of the bill, it basically extends time that juveniles can go through sex offender treatment. It allows a continuance to be granted all the way up to 24 months. Currently, you could essentially get to 1 year. And as we discussed this at great length in the Predatory Offender Working Group, typically treatment takes at least a year, sometimes more, and then there isn't any time for follow-up to see are they actually moved away from their predatory offender behaviors. Have they been reformed, I guess is another way to say it. And the judges simply don't have enough time to determine that when they're being told that they have to make their final determination. So this gives them that flexibility up to 2 years so that that juvenile can actually finish sex offender treatment. We found that to be incredibly important, and there are some counties that have found kind of a workaround the law, and anytime I see that as a lawmaker, I'm like, well, we need to change a law. If you are doing workarounds, then it's time to change a law, and we heard that in the working group. The last thing that it would do is it, so this one's a little complicated, members. We had a few court cases that were conflicting, and then we also had, we went back and forth. And so I'll explain it briefly, but it relates to the effective date that we're going to have non-person research explain. But it closes the loophole that requires registration for possession of child sexual abuse material, so pornographic child material, but not for dissemination. So if you look in the list in the statutes, it has very clearly one and not the other. And so we have actually two different case laws that are conflicting. While they're non-precedential, they are problematic, and we wanted to just address it head on. One case is Rye v. State. The other one is regarding the welfare of JCL, which is a juvenile. So these kind of came up as we were drafting this, and so the effective date that is there might be the most complicated and precise effective date I've ever seen in my 12 years here. I do want to just speak briefly to that if the nonpartisan researcher, Mr. Johnson, would speak to how we arrived at that particular effective date and why the reason behind it.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Johnson, if you could walk us through that effective date that is in the A2 amendment.
Madam Chair, members, the effective date is in the A2 amendment. You can see it beginning on page 1, line 5, and it runs all the way through 1.14. Many of you are familiar with a standard effective date that appears in most criminal statutes that says something to the effect of this is effective on, it'll say August 1, 20-something, and applies to crimes committed on or after that date. In 2020, the state Supreme Court decided a decision called Tapia versus Leslie. Do this as briefly as I can, but in Tapia, the legislature had amended the definition for crimes of violence in the statute you're familiar with related to the possession of firearms. Mm-hmm. In making that change, they removed an offense from that definition. A person who had been convicted of that offense previously applied to get a permit to purchase a firearm and was denied under the theory that he had previously committed a crime of violence. When that went to the state Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court said that the effective date, the reference to a crime, did not refer to the crime that was removed from the definition, that instead it was essentially referring to a theoretical potential crime for being an ineligible person in possession of a firearm. These two statutes are similar enough. This was actually raised for me by someone else and said, do you think this is a concern? And after reviewing the case, I said, I think it could be. And the potential is that in making the change here, that the legislative intent is to remove this false imprisonment crime for moving forward prospectively and not retroactively. The concern is that without a very detailed effective date, it would have a retroactive impact. Since the desire is to have it be a prospective impact moving forward from this date, you have the fairly detailed clause one, which is just making it clear that the change that you see in the main part of the bill on page 2, line 10, that's striking the false imprisonment, that is the change that becomes effective.
and it does not change anyone who's currently required to register for having committed that offense. Clause 2 is shorter. As Representative Rarick noted, there are a couple of somewhat conflicting Court of Appeals cases that are non-precedential, and this is just making it clear that to the extent that there has been a decision that disseminating pornographic work involving a minor is not the same as possessing pornographic work involving a minor, previous decisions of courts will remain the same. Anyone who was ordered to register based on that will continue to do so, but there would not be an attempt to go back and change that for people who had not been ordered to do so. There seems to be a difference of interpretation around the state, but this would clarify that going forward, anyone convicted of both of those offenses would be required to register. I hope that was as clear as could be.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. And it was, I think, helpful for the committee, but also in the future, if there is ever any question, it's always good to get the intent on the record. So, Representative Rarick, I just wanted to make sure that that is your intent with the amendment. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, thank you for the courts that will be reviewing this in the future. That is my intent. So any crime that was committed on or after that effective date that is still not settled in court, then this effective date would apply to that for those sections listed. And thank you, Mr. Johnson, for being so precise. And again, this might be the most precise and complicated effective date I've ever seen in my 12 years here now. So thank you. That's all I have, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. Well, next we'll move on and see if there's any public testimony on this bill. All right, I am not seeing any. We can move to member discussion, and I'll just note as well, I really appreciate all your work on this, on the CSC working group. It's been a pleasure to work in tandem with you on these issues. And then one of the things we talked about with the not wanting this to be retroactive, we can certainly look at some kind of off-ramp in the future. That's going to have a cost, and that was one reason why we were unable really to bring that this year, but we do think that that is important. Something that we should continue to talk about. And then I'll also just note, since the Wetterling's name has been brought up a few times, Patty Wetterling was on the working group, and she very much feels like the predatory offender registration has been expanded too far. And she, in fact, wanted no juveniles to be on the registry. So just wanted to make sure we noted that because, like I said, her name has been brought up a few times. Do we have any member questions? Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just echoing the thanks to Representative Rarick and to you, Chair, because you spent a lot of time on this as well. As a prosecutor now for more than 15 years, I've run into the challenges, Representative Rarick, that you identified and real frustrations with this system. And I guess I just want to highlight, as long as you brought it up, and expand on it, just the point about the false imprisonment, that in addition to the challenge that you referenced, there are ways in which having that be a registrable offense actually makes us less safe and causes people to be not held accountable for things that they've done, because the problem is you talked about there may be some negotiation where maybe a prosecutor is saying, oh, I could charge false imprisonment and instead somebody pleads to something else, and that may cause some concerns on the other side. But sometimes there's not another felony for them to plead to. Sometimes that is the only thing. And then you got a situation where there's no sexual aggressiveness at all involved. It's felony level behavior, and then suddenly you're going to charge somebody with what should be a relatively low level felony, but still is felonious behavior, and now suddenly we're going to be tracking them as a predatory offender, much more likely to go to trial, much more likely to spend a ton of resources on that situation with nothing sexual happening at all in that situation. I'm happy to describe more details about the kinds of cases I have in mind, but they've come up for me. That's just one example of what this bill would address and fix. So thanks to you, and thanks again to the chair for working so hard on a really important and challenging area. Thanks.
Vice Chair Feist.
Thank you. I was wondering, with respect to the false imprisonment changes, why not make that retroactive?
Representative Burr.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So we would like to do that, but it does cause, it basically creates an off-ramp, which causes expense. So I wish you could have been with us in the statutory reform working group for the POR, because we asked a multitude of questions like that. And right now, the data accessibility, the database just is not very good. So it would literally be a manual effort. So all 18,700 folks that are on the registry, you would have to go through case by case by case. And while that could be done and we could look at that at some point, that's basically what it would trigger. Not saying that we would not like relief. I certainly would like relief from those people, and especially with what Representative Pinto, I was going to say Chair Pinto, but that makes it confusing to our chair. Representative Pinto spoke of, we have those that really shouldn't be on the predatory offender list, as you noted, on it. And so now we're using BCA resources, law enforcement resources, and false positives, in a sense, if you want to look at it that way, of hits that might come up that are not relevant to cases. So that's essentially why. It's a really big ask. It's a manual look at everything. It's a very cumbersome database. And so that's going to take a lot longer to try to figure out how we do that. And quite frankly, several millions of dollars to do that, which unfortunately we probably don't have right now.
Yeah. And I'll just add too, there was nothing wrong with the database itself and how the BCA set that up. It was created for a very specific purpose, and this data collection piece just wasn't part of that. So certainly it's no criticism of them on how it's set up. It's just, we would love to do that data collection next year and look at the off-ramp and some of the other recommendations of the working group. Any further member questions or discussion? Closing comments, Representative Rarick.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I, you know, this is an area of law that is difficult to work in, and I appreciate working alongside of you. And, you know, there are actually 25 members of the statutory predatory offender list working group. We had quite a range, all the way from law enforcement to even Patty Wetterling herself. And so we had a variety of ideas. And what I always hone in on, members, is making sure that this is a useful tool for law enforcement, that the public is more safe, not less safe, which I believe is what this is doing. And the pieces that we did, were willing to move forward, were consensus pieces. So this is something that all those at the table from all walks of the judicial system, so to speak, were in favor of doing. So that's what we're moving forward today, and I appreciate the time. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Rarick, and I will renew the motion and lay over House File 3555 as amended. I'm going to turn the gavel over to, yeah, that's fine. You can move over here. I'm going to turn the gavel over to Vice Chair Feist because I have a couple bills up. The next bill on today's agenda is House File 4020, Chair Mueller's bill. Chair Mueller, would you like to move your bill?
I will do that, Madam Chair, and I believe the motion is that House File 4020 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law.
Thank you. Your bill is before us. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. So House File 4020 is a bill that also relates to predatory offender registration. This is a bill that is an agency bill and is brought by the BCA. It makes a couple of changes, and I would like to turn it over to them to explain those changes.
Great. Superintendent Evans, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Vice Chair Feist and members of the committee. Again, my name is Drew Evans, the superintendent at the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and we appreciate you taking the time to hear this bill. Mr. Johnson was explaining, with it comes to this, clarity is really important when it comes to this registry, and I very much appreciate the authors, as the individual that gets sued with these on a monthly basis, that we create that clarity. But there are a couple of things that will that have created challenges for individuals on the registry, and I give you an overview of the registry, but our number one goal with the registry is to ensure compliance. The goal of the registry is that we have the information by the offenders that are required to register, and that when changes occur with those individuals, that there is an opportunity to ensure that they are compliant. And there are some situations that have arisen where an individual, because it's been referenced, this is a complicated area of the law at times, that it's difficult for them to ensure compliance. And a couple of those have to do with when an offender moves to a different state and a situation where they're under conservatorship or they are incapacitated for some reason. The first change that would be addressed here is when an individual is no longer in the state of Minnesota and they are required to register, that there are additional mechanisms that are in place for us to verify their status and being registered in a different state. What the bill does is it allows us to confirm that the offender's updated registration in another state using their public website, showing they are registered in that state and compliant there. We can confirm their address with local law enforcement. So in other words, we would contact that local law enforcement in a different state. They would have confirmed the individual is there, and we would create compliance that way. And confirming an offender's residence through another state's incarceration, probation, public health, or motor vehicle records. Really what we've had is situations where we know an individual is in a different state, but because we're unable to confirm, they show non-compliant in Minnesota, yet we know they're registered in a different state. So this really creates additional compliance in Minnesota, and it allows them to be confirmed in that state where they're residing. The second situation this would address is those situations where an individual is incapacitated. Right now, if a person is incapacitated and they can't fill out the paperwork, and there isn't a mechanism in place to have them confirm their registration documents that they're required to do every year, we run into some challenges with certain offenders where they're incapacitated and they show non-compliant, but yet we know where they are. And so this would allow guardians, conservators, or an individual with power of attorney to complete their registration or verification documents on behalf of those individuals who do not have the capacity or capability of completing them independently. We think this is good public policy in terms of we know where the individual is, we have a person that's responsible for them, they can complete those verification or registration requirements, and they will show compliant in our system with that particular change. And so with that, that is an overview of what these changes would do, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. And do we have anyone from the public who would like to testify on this bill? Seeing no one, we will move on to member discussion. Any comments from the committee? Nope. Chair Mueller, any closing comments?
Thank you.
Oh, I actually had a question.
Oh, all right.
I just remembered. I'm so sorry. I was just curious about how the system works if somebody passes away while they're on the registry.
Vice Chair Feist and members of the committee, it's actually a really good question. So we need to verify that they've deceased through records. So their death certificate we receive and we obtain a copy of that, and then we remove them from the registry at that point in time.
If no one sends it to you?
Good question. If no one sends it to us, our staff, so we have a staff that maintains the registry at the BCA, and so they will go out and seek that through the medical examiner's office, and then we can verify it that way. So that is one of the things that we go through. They have a number of different databases they're able to query when we go into that non-compliant status, which may occur, but then we will be able to rectify it by getting the proper records.
Thank you so much. Interesting. Chair Mueller, any closing comments?
Just appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Mueller renews her motion that House File 4020 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary and Finance and Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. The next bill on our agenda is House File 4019, also Chair Mueller's bill. Chair Mueller, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I will move that House File 4019 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law.
Great, your bill is before us. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. So this is another agency bill. This is the Department of Public Safety, Office of Justice Programs. It's really also providing some more clarity around certain provisions related to victims of crime. And I do have a testifier here who can go into more detail.
Thank you. Director Weeks, please state your name and title for the record and proceed.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Kate Weeks. I'm the Executive Director of the Office of Justice Programs with the Department of Public Safety. Before you is House File 4019, and it does three different things. One is it addresses the Minnesota Sexual Assault Payment Program that was enacted last year. Before, 87 different counties provided reimbursement for sexual assault claims. That has now transferred over to the Office of Justice Programs. There are certain protections in place already for the information that OJP receives in order to process these claims. We are just the identifying information for a victim is already protected under current law. We would like to extend additional protections to any medical information that is also provided to us when we process those claims. And so this would provide protections that are similar to what we have for the Crime Victim Reimbursement Program, which is another program that we operate that does collect sensitive data. The second piece is making sure that we have consistent definitions of crime victims throughout statute. Minnesota Statute 611A provides definitions for crime victim rights in the state of Minnesota. So we are trying to make sure that the definition of crime victim throughout different pieces of statute are consistent with that definition. And so similar updates were made last year in the public safety omnibus bill. And so this is, we found additional references to crime victims throughout the statutes. And so this provides some consistency throughout statutes. The final one is addressing the crime victim reimbursement program. It's making clear that additional crowdsourcing or private donations or gifts after a violent crime are not to be considered when we're making crime victim reimbursement decisions. And so it provides clarity for our staff. Often that information is unreliable and difficult to secure. So it just provides continuity and consistency for implementation of those claims. And I am here for any questions.
Thank you so much. Is there anyone from the public who would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we do have an A1 amendment. Who would like to offer that amendment?
That would be me, Vice Chair.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you. As we were meeting with the DPS representatives yesterday and looking over the bill, we did notice one thing that we would like to change. The A1 amendment, instead of striking the lines or benefits of any private source provided as a voluntary donation or gift, we thought we would move that into the excluded territory just so we could provide clarification to the crime victims that they are receiving, if they are receiving private donations, it won't count against them in determining reimbursement amounts. Received a response from DPS early this morning that they were fine with that language, and speaking with Chair Moeller, she indicated that she would accept it. Once again, this doesn't, this just, instead of striking that language, putting it into a thing so that anyone reads it understands that that is still allowable.
Chair Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I accept this as a friendly amendment and encourage the committee to vote yes.
Thank you. So Representative Novotny moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion prevails. There are no other amendments on this bill, so we will move to member discussion. Are there any questions by the committee? I have a really random question. And since I'm here, I guess I just feel like empowered to ask random questions. On line 2.12, where we're talking about the definition of victim and making it consistent across statutes, we've listed the deceased person. And I was just curious if that means that the victim could have died as a result of the crime that they were a victim of, or are we saying that a deceased person can be a victim of a crime after, like, they are deceased already?
So, Chair members,
Director Weeks.
Yep. I would like to call up Suzanne Elwell from the director of our Crime Victim Justice Unit that can better answer that question and potentially provide specific examples that might help clarify.
Thank you so much. Ms. Elwell, please introduce yourself again and proceed.
Vice Chair, again, my name is Suzanne Elwell with the Office of Justice Programs. In answer to your question, under the definition of crime victim, a person who is deceased is a victim. But included within the definition of crime victim are those family members of a deceased victim. So both, as we look at our statute, both are considered victims. So yes, a deceased person is a victim, as are their family members.
Thank you. Great. Any other discussion? Seeing no other discussion, Chair Moeller, any closing comments?
This is also a good bill. Please vote yes.
Thank you so much. Chair Moeller renews her motion that House File 4019, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, the motion prevails. Thank you.
All right, the last bill on today's agenda is House File 1930. Oh, sorry. This is Representative Freiberg's bill, and welcome to the committee, Representative Freiberg. I will move that House File 1930 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. And just as a reminder to the committee and the public, we will be focusing our attention in this committee today in both our discussion and our testimony on sections 13 and 14 of the bill, which relate to criminal penalties. Representative Freiberg, your bill is before us. I do believe you have an author's amendment, the A9. Is there anything you wanted to say about the A9 amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Yes, this amendment just clarifies the effective dates throughout the bill. And it broadens the review of the forms that the commissioner is supposed to review.
All right, so I will move the A9 amendment. All those in favor of the A9 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the A9 amendment is adopted. And then we will move to the other amendments after we hear from the bill author and take testimony. So your bill as amended is before us. Representative Freiberg, please explain your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, for taking time for this important bill. The Minnesota End of Life Options Act is modeled after an Oregon law, which has been in effect since 1997. 10 states and the District of Columbia have enacted similar laws since that time. And I know we're focusing in this committee on sections 13 and 14, but just so you have a general sense for the bill, the main criteria for medical aid in dying have remained unchanged since I first introduced this bill in 2015. To qualify for it, a person has to be an adult, meaning they're 18 or over. They have to be diagnosed with a terminal illness with a prognosis of 6 months or less to live. They have to have the mental capacity to make healthcare decisions and provide informed consent, so people with dementia don't qualify. They have to have the ability to self-administer medication, so injections or infusions are prohibited. Additionally, two providers must evaluate the patient and agree that they meet the qualifications. Both providers have to confirm that the patient is acting of their own volition and not subject to coercion. They have to inform the patient of all feasible end-of-life care options, including hospice and symptom management. They have to provide a referral to hospice if indicated. And they have to offer the patient the option to rescind the request at any time. So just speaking to the provisions within this committee's jurisdiction, Section 13 establishes penalties for coercion that align with the current Minnesota Statute 609.27. So coercion can include intentionally altering or falsifying a request for medical aid in dying medication for another individual, intentionally destroying, mutilating, or concealing another individual's rescission of a request, compelling another individual to request medical aid in dying medication through the use of coercion, undue influence, harassment, duress, compulsion, or other enticement, or compelling another individual to self-administer medical aid in dying medication through the use of coercion. And just to be clear, though, you know, it's important that we have these protections in place, but in the states that allow for medical aid in dying, there is no verifiable evidence of abuse. You have a letter in your packet from the Disability Rights Oregon organization that indicates there have been no reports of abuse related to the Oregon law that's been in effect. Section 14 does two things. It specifically prohibits medication delivery via lethal injection, lethal infusion, and prohibits participation in criminal acts. And it specifies that actions taken in accordance with the chapter do not constitute suicide, assisted suicide, homicide, or anything along those lines. Each of the 11 jurisdictions that authorize medical aid in dying have similar provisions in place. And I've asked a clinician and expert in suicide prevention to speak to this, to speak to these sections of law.
Thank you. And I'll just note there were a number of letters that were submitted both in favor of and opposed to this bill. So thank you to everybody that submitted that written testimony. There were so many, and then we did talk to our colleagues across the aisle. We did not print them for all the packets, but both the GOP and the DFL, we have a packet of letters here, the physical copy, and of course all of them are also posted online for anybody in the public to review those letters. And I believe your testifier is Eric Berg, so if you want to come on forward, please. And you can introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you very much for allowing me to be here today. My name is Eric Berg. I'm a retired licensed psychologist in the state of Minnesota after 40 years of clinical practice at psychiatric hospitals, mental health clinics, private practice, and finally the counseling center at St. Olaf College. I've trained clinical interns in assessing suicidality. I've designed a gatekeeping suicide prevention model and trained teachers, public safety officers, residential life staff in these programs. I also served on the board of directors of Suicide Awareness of Voice of Education as a volunteer speaker and then on the board for 16 years. I am, however, only speaking for myself, not representing Suicide Awareness Voice of Education, which is a great organization. Personally, I've walked beside hundreds of good people in the throes of suicidal crisis and done whatever I could to keep them safe until the crisis subsided. I lost my own brother to suicide by firearm in 1997. Losing him so suddenly and so violently was quite traumatic. There was so much wondering about last thoughts, so many questions about why then, why there, anger at exposing our mother to the direct consequence of having to find his body. I lost my father to cancer in 1989 after witnessing his horrific suffering as cancer consumed his body. This desire to end life at that point could not be more difficult. Could not be more different from the situation involving my brother. House File 1930 underscores that the very specific criterion guidelines required for the practice of mental aid in dying should not be considered with suicide or assisted suicide. Suicide occurs as a result of a mental health crisis that drives individuals to take or try to take their own lives, usually impulsively and often by violent means. They are self-destructive and not in a rational state of mind. This is very clear when you talk to them. They are generally in an agitated state of perceived helplessness, hopelessness, and desperation and despair. They are cognitively impaired by a condition or situation that is treatable and or reversible with appropriate intervention. By contrast, patients who request medical aid in dying are suffering from an irreversible physical illness that is likely to result in death in 6 months. They have decisional capacity. They can understand their disease and prognosis and the significance of their situation. And they are suffering. The decision to use medical aid in dying is made over time in consultation with their loved ones and their healthcare team. They can communicate their wishes with a clear cognitive understanding of what options are available. The majority of patients who will request medical aid in dying are enrolled in hospice, receiving maximum comfort care, and are served by an interdisciplinary team of health professionals who are focused on the patient's physical, psychological, social, and spiritual needs. Medical aid in dying is an end-of-life option similar to discontinuing renal dialysis or other life-sustaining treatment or the decision to stop eating and drinking. It is an autonomous decision made by the individual, but with support from the medical team. Because medical aid in dying requires the patient to self-ingest the medication, it is not euthanasia. Although some have expressed concern, there's absolutely no sound research that indicates that medical aid in dying has impact on suicide rates or causes suicide contagion. The fact is that suicide rates in Oregon, for example, rose after its Death with Dignity law was enacted. While this is technically true, it is misleading because suicide rates increased in every U.S. state that year and continue to do so. Suicide prevention is hard work. It's exhausting to sit with an individual through a mental health crisis trying to keep them alive and safe. These folks are not at peace in any way with their urge to die. Sitting with a terminally ill person, forcing them to stay alive or to suffer and waste away from disease is not noble, and it can be cruel. With decades of data and experience from authorizing states, we don't need to speculate. The End of Life Options Act has the same time-tested guardrails as the other 10 states that have resulted in the laws being used thoughtfully, compassionately, and safely. And I encourage you to support House File 1930. Thank you for the opportunity to share my views and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. And I just want to acknowledge that this is a very difficult topic to talk about. It evokes a lot of emotions from people. A lot of us have personal experiences that we think about when we talk about this issue. And so I just want to acknowledge that. And anybody, if you need to step out and come back in on the committee, in the public, whatever, please feel free to do so because it really is something that can be hard to talk about. So we now will move to public testimony. All the testifiers have signed up in advance. We ask that public testimony be limited to sections 13 and 14 of the bill. We have four testifiers. All have been given a 90-second limit. We do have a little more time than we thought, so we can extend that to 2 minutes. And before you begin your testimony, please state your name and title for the record. The first person on the list is Executive Director Ellen Kennedy. Welcome. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Dr. Ellen Kennedy, Executive Director of World Without Genocide and an adjunct professor of law at Mitchell Hamlin School of Law. I'm here in a personal capacity to support this bill. This option is available to nearly 300 million people worldwide and to 74 million people in 10 states and Washington, D.C. Last year, my husband, Dr. Lee Lawton, died of multiple myeloma, an incurable form of blood cancer. For 3 years at the Mayo Clinic, he tried every option for his life. Nothing worked. He was ready to die when the elements of his life, as he defined it, were gone. But for 16 excruciating days, his personhood slowly eroded because he had no options in death. This bill for medical aid in dying, known as MAID, protects patients from coercion, manipulation, and harm. Sections 13 and 14 deter and penalize would-be abusers of medical aid in dying with felony charges and with increasing prison terms of incarceration for up to 25 years and financial fines. There are other laws that can be applicable as appropriate. MAID first passed nearly 30 years ago in Oregon. Cumulative longitudinal data from 11 U.S. jurisdictions with MAID show no substantial cases of abuse or coercion. No civil or criminal charges have ever been filed, not one. Disability Rights Oregon has never received a complaint that a disabled person was coerced into using medical aid in dying. MAID's safeguards for patients and penalties for would-be abusers work. Some people may oppose MAID for cultural or religious reasons. I ask only that they do not deny it.
Executive Director Kennedy, that it's beyond 2 minutes, so if you could wrap up, please.
My husband's last wish of me was to help pass this bill. Please honor his dying request. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up is Greg Deckert. Hi, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good morning. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Greg Deckert. I am an attorney. I've been practicing in the state of Minnesota for 36 years. I own and practice law at a law firm in Maple Grove that specializes in estate planning, estate administration, and elder law. Much of our practice focuses on representing elderly clients and clients who are disabled. I'm here to testify in opposition to the proposed bill as it relates to the lack of adequate legal safeguards for protecting our state's most vulnerable citizens. There are many more, but I will mention four. First, the supposed safeguards in this bill are an evidentiary charade because Section 13 will rarely, if ever, be enforced. There simply won't be reliable witnesses. When an attempt at coercion is successful, the patient will be deceased. I have tried many will contests, and my office routinely litigates issues of coercion, undue influence, duress, and lack of capacity. These legal theories are easy to allege, but they are extremely difficult to prove in court. And this bill does nothing to protect our state's vulnerable population in that regard. Second, only one witness is required. And this person may be a complete stranger who knows nothing about the patient or her medical history. In other words, it will be easier in this state, in terms of the signing requirements, to get a dose of lethal medication than it will be to execute a simple will or a trust or a power of attorney or even a health care directive. Third, once the medication is prescribed, there is no oversight over the pills. There is a provision for disposal, but there are no penalties. This medication could be used on vulnerable people, and we all know that autopsies are almost unheard of in cases involving the elderly or those with chronic illnesses.
And Mr. Decker, we're at 2 minutes, but can you please make your fourth point?
Fourth, once the pills are prescribed, there is no requirement that administration be witnessed. There is therefore no way of knowing who administered the pills, whether it was the patient or some other person with bad intentions. And because it's presumed the patient self-administered, this statute invites abuse by estate beneficiaries. So I urge the committee to reject this dangerous legislation.
Thank you
for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up is Dennis O'Hare. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Dr. Dennis O'Hare. I am a family physician and geriatrician. I work daily with the disabled and elderly and assisted living and memory care units. That's where I came from this morning. I'm also a member of the Minnesota Medical Association. I spent the previous 4 years chairing their ethics and legal committee, and I'm an elected delegate from Minnesota to the American Medical Association. I'm here to speak in opposition to this bill in regards to Section 14B, which states actions taken in accordance with this chapter do not for any purposes constitute suicide, assisted suicide, or other terms. This is not accurate. Any definition of suicide will show this is about suicide. And the Council on Ethics and Judicial Affairs of the American Medical Association states, quote, ethical deliberation and debate is best served by using plainly descriptive language. Despite its negative connotations, the term physician-assisted suicide describes the practice with the greatest precision. The terms aid in dying or death with dignity could be used to describe either euthanasia or palliative and hospice care at the end of life, and this degree of ambiguity is unacceptable for providing ethical guidance. This bill is not about medical aid in dying. Every physician who works with the dying already prescribes many medications to take care of symptoms at the end of life. We all do this, and we don't need a bill to provide that. This bill is about legalizing physician-assisted suicide and making it a standard of care that the American Medical Association states is unethical and, quote, fundamentally incompatible with the physician's role as healer, would be difficult or impossible to control, and would pose serious societal risk. After years of debate and all the data you've already seen and other data in the country, over 80% of the 600-plus elected delegates from every state and specialty reaffirmed that language, that this is unethical and incompatible for a physician. And because it is suicide, it will have the effect.
We're well beyond 2 minutes now, so a closing sentence. Okay, great. Thank you.
Because it is suicide, it will have the effect of undermining our other suicide prevention efforts, likely lead to increased suicide rates, and therefore is a threat to public safety. Please do not move this bill forward. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. And then we have John Milkey. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Mueller and committee members. Thank you for taking my testimony today. I'm John Milkey. I'm a practicing internist and geriatrician. I've been doing so for 40 years. I am the Chief Medical Officer of Presbyterian Homes and Services and past president of the Minnesota Medical Directors Association. I'm speaking on my own behalf today. Section 13 of House File 1390 is concerned with coercion of our frail, elderly, and dying patients, as it should be. My dying patients are among the most susceptible to coercion, undue influence, and other forms of exploitation. This law, however, is, in its essence, coercive. Let me explain. The new law sets a standard of care for medicine, for me, medical aid in dying. then it obligates all providers to inform those dying patients of all options, including this new standard of care. At each decision point with my dying or frail patients, I must inform them of the option of medical aid in dying. This repeated so-called informed consent begins to set an expectation with my vulnerable patients that perhaps their life is not worth living. So rather than supporting my patients, providing dignity and comfort, I am forced to remind them that we could end their life prematurely. These discussions between physicians and patients, whether we like it or not, carry tremendous weight, and by forcing me to inform them of this new option should the bill pass, is coercive in its very nature. I believe the bill should not be passed. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, we are going to move on now to the A13 amendment and then to member discussion. Who will be offering the A13 amendment?
We're withdrawing that, Chair.
Okay, the A13 amendment has been withdrawn. So now we will go ahead and move to member discussion on the bill. Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Freiberg, according to a medical journal study that was published in the National Library of Medicine in their database, researchers noted a 6.3% increase in suicides associated with legalizing assisted suicide. I've heard a couple of testifiers say that this isn't the case. I've heard a couple that have said that this is the case, and they are working in the field. So could you describe to me whether or not that's the case?
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Engen. As we heard from Dr. Berg, there was an increase in the rate of suicide in Oregon after the law passed. However, there was an increase in every other state as well. So I would guess I'd push back a little bit on your statement that there's a relation between the two. That we heard from Dr. Berg that the conditions which cause people to use medical aid in dying are not the same as suicide. So this bill will not lead to an increase in suicide. I think it's been demonstrated in the states that have had it.
Any follow-up? Representative Ingen.
I think that was fairly contradictory, but I'll stop my question.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Freiberg, for bringing this forward. I guess, fortunate enough that I don't have to struggle with whether or not this is something that I support. My grandmother, who passed away in 2011, was a huge supporter of medical aid in dying, and for that reason, and for what I saw her go through as she passed away, where she suffered for years, it's easy for me to support this bill. I have a couple of more comments than questions. I guess we've heard that this poses a serious societal risk, but I would push back and say that it's been passed in 10 states as well as DC, and we haven't seen society collapse. I would also wager to say, I mean, I have practiced in a state law, and I agree that it can get controversial at times, but I think this notion that like we are all surrounded by like homicidal individuals who are ready to like pull the plug on people because of potential gains in estates is simply inaccurate. I think most of us really care about our aging relatives. We support them and their decisions. And for me, I truly respect that we have people from medicine up here saying that this is bad, but I have hundreds of letters from elder adults in my district that are saying they support this bill and that they want to have that option and have that, have autonomy over their choices. And so I have to respect that, what they're asking me to do. So I thank you for bringing this bill forward, and I plan on supporting it.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to thank the author, as we've been having almost ongoing daily discussions about this bill. And I thank God I sit next to two lawyers, because they've been helping me through this, the verbiage here.
Representative Pinto just commented that's the only time anybody's ever uttered a sentence like that before. Go ahead, Representative Hewitt.
So anyways, to the author, I'm kind of concerned with one of the testifiers and somebody compels another person to carry this out or helps them in any way, if I'm understanding this right and with the help of my friends here, that's illegal. Is that correct according to the statute?
Representative Freiberg.
Yeah, that's yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Yes, if you go to Section 13 of the bill, starting on page 15, line 22, it lists all of the things that will become felonies under this law, and that includes coercion. So, there are two attending providers who are involved in the evaluation of the person plus hospice oversight. So, I do think, you know, there is an opportunity to determine if that has happened. But as we've heard also, there is no evidence that coercion has ever occurred in the 25 years it's been the law in Oregon.
Go ahead, Representative Hewitt.
One follow-up. And so I'm also not seeing, and again, trying to read through this, that there is any law in here or any statement in here about someone seeking counsel from, let's say, a minister or somebody, and then that minister sharing their creed about the subject. I don't see anything in here stating that that would be illegal or wrong. Is that, am I reading it right?
Representative Freiberg.
No, there's nothing in there. I mean, this is a little bit outside of the sections we're talking about, but there's specifically a section in the bill that says there's no duty to provide medical aid in dying. So nobody is forced to participate in it. If it's like if a doctor, for example, if it's against their beliefs, they do not have to administer it.
And sorry, I should have explained. And I met within the sections we're responsible in here. I see nothing in those sections that govern in our committee, right? Yeah, that's exactly right then. So there is no, if a minister does this, they're not going to be prosecuted by any means or anything like that with helping with somebody or not helping but counseling them during this. There's no ramifications for them.
Yeah, there's no ramifications for ministers at all.
Okay.
On this.
Last comment, and this is more that Representative Freiberg, I definitely appreciate you going through this. And I do think that this has to be well vetted as it's going through a lot of committees, and it's a real big take, and I appreciate you doing that. And I think that's what I want it to go through more committees. So thank you for your time on this.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I find it telling that when concern is raised over the societal harm that this bill risks, that the example that we have to go to, the extreme that we have to present in order to combat that notion is complete societal collapse. It seems a little odd to me that the only possible form of societal harm is the total collapse and shutdown of society. Now, perhaps harm to an individual ought to be a high enough concern for this committee. The idea that we need not worry about abuse, we need not worry about bad actors. That's the only reason this committee exists. Public safety. We exist to deal with the fact that there are bad actors in our society. And we need to be very careful in our actions to ensure that we're illuminating the blind spots and putting up the safety nets to prevent abuse. I don't want to argue about statistics and things that I know we're not going to agree about. What I just want to speak to, two things, and I'll be done. One, I really think what should center all of our deliberation on public policy is the value of human life. It's intrinsic value. And I dislike the characterization of that as an exclusively faith-based or cultural idea. Objectively, the standard of value is life. There's nothing else, literally, nothing else. There's no reason, no basis for morality. Morality is the code we utilize in order to make decisions. Why? For what purpose? What makes a choice good or bad? Objectively, a choice is good if it furthers life. This does not. I think we ought to take that into consideration. I also dislike the idea that the only path towards dignified death is jumping off the cliff, causing death. That's where dignity is found, in causing death, not in enduring, not in those last years, those last weeks, those last hours of persisting. Dignity isn't found there, apparently. It's only found in checking out. That's a weird premise. I don't like it. I'm done.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Representative Hudson. I'm actually glad you raised the issue of this use of the word dignity, and I actually agree with you completely. The Oregon law was passed by initiative. It's called the Death with Dignity Law in Oregon. So there was, since it was on the ballot, there was no opportunity to change it legislatively. I avoid using that term because I think there's dignity in whatever people choose at the end of life. And honestly, that's part of the reason I support this. I think there's dignity in people, you know, living through it, going through hospice care. I think there's dignity in using palliative care. I think there's dignity in voluntarily stop eating and drinking. And I think there's dignity in choosing to use medical aid and dying. I think those all contain equal dignity. I don't agree that this harms an individual. I think it protects and respects their autonomy, and I think it's consistent with a lot of the legislation we've passed this year, but I do appreciate you raising those issues, and especially the issue about dignity, because I do like to take any opportunity I can to say that that's generally not a term that I use.
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you so much, Chair Freiberg, for bringing this forward. This is something that I'm hearing about a lot from my community. I won't repeat what's been said. My community is essentially on the same page as what we heard from Representative Hollins. I'm just constantly being asked to please pass this. And I have to agree the point about dignity. In order for us to have full dignity, you have to have choices. And we, you know, I talk about this in the human services space too, that the more you try to put people in a bubble, the more you remove dignity of risk and dignity in general for that person. We can't just control people's options for our own level of comfort. And so, you know, that, you know, I'd say that, you know, this goes beyond just this issue, but sticking just to this bill, I think I absolutely agree that there's a multitude of ways that people, you know, leave this world. And I think there's dignity in all of those ways. I did have a quick question that I just wanted to clarify, that folks who are under guardianship are not eligible. Is that, can you confirm that for me?
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Correct, Representative Curran.
Anything else, Representative Curran?
No, thank you. Appreciate it.
Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, I'm not going to say thank you for bringing this bill forward, like so many have already done, because I don't think this is the right way to go. I've listened to all the testifiers, and they make good points. Both sides bring up valid points. However, again, I'll echo Representative Hudson's concerns of how human life in recent years, and it's been ongoing for a long time, is more and more being devalued in this society. And that should terrify all of us. That should terrify all of us. Human life is a gift. Human life is something to be treasured from conception until natural death. That's the bottom line, folks. And I look at where this originally came from out in Oregon. Canada got theirs from Oregon, their MAID system. And that MAID system, if you look at that, those are the horrifying things that this has the potential to become, to where it's open to very, very many people, not just the terminally ill, and it's they're introducing, they're entertaining making it accessible to individuals as young as 15 years old. Okay. So when we open Pandora's box and allow something like this to come in, I think we all have to be very, very cautious and mindful how much we are going down a path of darkness to destruction when we open these, we'll open up this box and let this thing out. And I do have a question. Are the diagnosis, the 6-month diagnosis, are those for their terminal illness, are those 100% accurate?
Representative Freiberg.
Sure. We're getting, with the chair's discretion, yep. I can answer it. It's a little beyond the scope of this committee, but it's never 100% accurate. I can say, though, that there's a lot of data from Oregon showing that the conditions that lead to people using medical aid in dying follow a very predictable path. Most of the people who use medical aid in dying are dying from certain types of cancer or from ALS, and it is very predictable. Certainly, if people live longer or outlive a prognosis, that's a good thing. That's what we want. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, I think we have to trust our medical providers to use their best judgment.
Thank you.
Madam Chair. Anything else, Representative Grassl?
Okay, thank you. And that's exactly, and, you know, it's kind of ironic that the people behind me giggle. It's sad,
Grassl,
but anyway,
to the bill.
I'll stay on point. When these people get these diagnoses, it's really no different than the as far as being traumatic, and they're going through something that is very difficult, something that they didn't expect to get this, but here it is. You've got 6 months to live. And as far as these people that are committing suicide, being in a place of such darkness, and that's been a question of mine forever. How do you get to that point? What's going on there? But now we have a place to where you can look at, they've been given, this is that point. You can't tell me that these people aren't under the same duress as those who have psychological issues that drive them to that point. So without this being, I mean, it's suicide, no matter how you look at it, folks. It's suicide. You're ending a human life unnaturally. I would like a lot of people, I've watched my parents go through their illnesses and pass away. But they didn't take this route. And I'm glad they didn't. And I hope nobody here has to decide on this, on taking this route. I really do. And I pray that we go the right direction and not support this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So, Representative Ingen, you raised your hand again. We typically don't go back again once you've talked already. I will allow it only if it is to Section 13 and Section 14.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Must there be a witness present when this is self-administered? So, and that goes to the coercion piece. Who's going to be reporting coercion if the person who's already availed themselves using assisted suicide has already passed?
Representative Freiberg.
Give me one moment. I'm just. Yeah, the. Yeah, as I said, there are two attending providers involved in the evaluation, plus there's hospice oversight. Almost all of the patients in Oregon who've gone through this are also in hospice at the same time, so there are witnesses present.
Right. Representing again.
There must be a witness present, or there are if they want subjective. No,
well,
yes, it's pretty black and white, I think.
I think just like in any criminal situation or any criminal case or charges or looking at potential criminal charges, you have to look at what kind of witnesses might be available. And I think Representative Freiberg is saying these are often happening in settings where there are a lot of people around, and given the attending physicians that are there and others who are around, if there is evidence of coercion, you're going to have witnesses in those circumstances. Is that the correct understanding, Representative Freiberg?
Yes, thank you.
All right, Representative Novotny.
Chair Mohler, a couple quick questions. Where is this bill going from here?
This bill is moving to the Judiciary Committee.
Thank you. In regards to Amendment 13 that we didn't bring up, I noticed that you did make a change in the language going from sampling of the forms to all of the forms for 4 years. Is there some magic bullet that'll happen in 2028 that we won't need the oversight?
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There is still oversight. The sampling language is what's used in other states, generally speaking, and it's worked fine. After that amendment that was withdrawn, I know was offered also in the Health Committee. I had some discussions with Representative Backer after that committee hearing, who had offered it, and we came up with this language instead. I thought he raised some interesting points about that, so we thought it was appropriate to review all the forms for the first few years, and then there would be an opportunity for the legislature to change it if need be, but based on the experience from other states, I don't think that will be necessary.
Lead Novotny.
Chair Mohler, in regards to Section 14, you specifically lay out several other ways to commit suicide. What's the difference?
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Novotny. We heard from Dr. Berg that people who are experiencing suicidal ideation are often agitated and not in a right place of mind. People who use medical aid in dying don't want to die, but they are already dying. They've been diagnosed as having a terminal illness. It's not easy to talk about, but I think there is a clear distinction between somebody who uses medical aid in dying and somebody who dies by suicide.
Lead Novotny.
Chair Mohler, we've got a little time. I'll dive into that, and I'll ask you the question as a guy who did 30 years of responding to death scenes, including suicides, 6.5 of those years, dedicated to investigations. My question, and maybe I should have been more clear, if someone meets all of the parameters that you've laid out, but they don't choose the state-approved method of suicide, and the state path to get there, what's the difference?
Representative Freiberg.
As I said, the people who use medical aid in dying are already dying, and they.
I'll go back to my.
Wait, hang on a second. Go ahead, Representative Freiberg.
I mean, I can also call back Dr. Berg if you'd like. I think he's more.
We
more familiar
have
with
to
the
move on to a vote, so I don't think we'll need to call him back at this point. But did you have any?
No, that's fine.
Okay, Lead Novotny.
Chair Mohler, the question is: someone that is in. They've met the state-approved method of committing suicide. They've checked all the boxes. Maybe they've even been provided the state-approved method of committing suicide through what you call medical-assisted suicide. But they just choose a different path. Their medical certificate or their death certificate has changed, and they've committed a crime. What's the difference, really?
So I think he's already answered this question, and perhaps you didn't like the answer.
Chair,
but we can keep asking it again and again and not moving forward. So,
well, I can't help him move forward and not answer the question. So we'll just – there's a secret database that we could all do, and I'll give you a little secret from everything that I've learned in my life. There's a secret database. You can go on your computer, and if you type into the search line, Google or DuckDuckGo, you'll find that everywhere that we've done state-approved medically assisted suicide, that there's problems. And it's a slippery slope, as several of the other members of my committee have said. It's just for this. We've got parameters. We've got guardrails. It's very specific. And then the next session comes around. It's, well, we'll just throw in just this one more exception. I think if you look through that same secret database, once again, it's Google or DuckDuckGo or whatever search you want to use, historically, this is a bad idea, and bad things happen. And if we don't protect the most vulnerable among us, pretty soon it's going downhill, and it's a slippery slope. There's no other way to say it. I'm struggling to find a movie from when I was younger, and I think it was 1984, the book, where we changed terms, and pretty soon the firefighters are the ones that are actually starting the fires. And that is another thing that really strikes me about this is now we're going to have the doctors who have supposedly dedicated their lives to saving people, and now that they're aiding them in suicide. Chair Mohler, I'm going to request a roll call vote on this, and I urge my members to vote no.
Closing comments, Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to that point, I mean, the slippery slope argument gets raised a lot. I can say every state that's adopted medical aid in dying laws have kept the basic safeguards in place, and the data show that they work in protecting people. There's no coercion. This is a bill that respects patient autonomy at the end of life. It's not an easy issue to talk about. I will certainly agree with that. But if I ever get to a point where I have to make this sort of decision, I know I would feel a lot better knowing that there's an option like this out there for me. And I've heard so many stories from Minnesotans who feel the same way, and just they've seen a loved one go through this, or they're going through it themselves. We have people here who are in the stages of terminal disease. So. You know, I respect the discussion, but in the end of the day, I hope members can find it in themselves to support this bill because it's really important. So thank you, Chair Mohler.
Thank you. I renew the motion that House File 1930, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. A roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mohler.
Aye.
Chair Mohler votes aye. Vice Chair Feist.
Aye.
Vice Chair Feist votes aye. Lead Novotny. Lead Novotny votes no. Representative Becker Finn.
Aye.
Representative Becker Finn votes aye. Representative Curran.
Aye.
Representative Curran votes aye. Representative Engen.
No.
Representative Engen votes no. Representative Grossel.
No.
Representative Grossel votes no. Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Hollins votes aye. Representative Hudson.
No.
Representative Hudson votes no. Representative Hewitt. Representative Mueller.
Mueller votes no.
Representative Mueller votes no. Representative Pinto.
Aye.
Representative Pinto votes aye. Representative Tabke.
Yes.
Representative Tabke votes yes. Representative Witte.
No.
Representative Witte votes no.
Madam Chair, I vote aye.
Representative Hewitt votes aye.
There being 8 ayes and 6 nays, the motion prevails. That concludes today's agenda. Members, we will see you Thursday, and this meeting is adjourned. Tuesday.